Hi, it's Sean D'Souza, and what you're listening to is a series called 22 Minutes with Sean. But what we're going to explore in this series is a whole bunch of questions that members at 5000 BC ask. We'll look at how these questions can be answered in a very short period of time so that you can move ahead. So here we go, 22 Minutes with Sean.
My name's Simon, and I am effectively running two little businesses for myself at the moment. On one hand, I have my what we call almost my Plan B business, not really starting my Plan A, but my Plan B business, which is my freelancing, and that's selling my time to ad agencies doing what's called effectively digital strategy. And so I spend my time sort of writing PowerPoint presentations and presenting to clients for ad agencies in London. I'm working on my Plan A, which is really why I'm on, part of 5000 BC and particularly interested in today. So my Plan A is really about trying to set up fairly similar to Sean, but, trying to sell to small businesses, but actually to a different niche. So those are the businesses who have an identity crisis and ideally start with over here in the UK and roll out from there. So that's what I'm doing a lot, spending 1 to 2, maybe 3 hours a day on as best I can at the moment.
Okay, let's do the questions.
Great. So the first question I have, well, so it's all about obviously information products, and this is really important, really of real interest to me. And I was going to ask you, when you're starting out, so I'm a real novice at the moment. I've never sort of written one before, but I'm trying to write one at the moment, and it has a lot of frustration to it as well. So the first one was about, when choosing your topic, what's the best way to do it? Do you actually end up writing for yourself, or do you actually write for an audience and try and sort of think what they want?
There are two ways to approach it. The first is the audience way, and the second is obviously for yourself. So that's the two ways, but when do you do which one? If you look at things like TV serials, you'll find that there are a whole bunch of detective TV serials that come out at the same time, the CSI kind of stuff that comes out at the same time, a whole bunch of, talent contests, a whole bunch of all kinds of things that seem very similar. And this is just riding on a fad, and a very profitable fad. So the first thing that you can do is, as a fad unfolds, say as the web unfolded, as social media unfolded, as blogs unfolded, as Pinterest unfolded, then if you were at the edge of that unfolding, or even in the middle of it, you could write something that would then be quickly lapped up by someone. So whenever something is unfolding, if you're able to figure out how to make that successful in some way, then you have an audience that is eager to figure out how you did it and how they should do it as well. That's one way to go about it. That's not the way I go about it. The way I go about it is to just create whatever I damn well please. And yeah, it interests me rather than anybody else. The way I then sell it is to link it to a problem. So most of the things, like say the brain audit is a problem of hesitation in sales. The testimonials is a problem with getting the right clients. So all of the things that I create are usually to improve my own skills in that field. And every time I create a new version, it's the same thing. It's about improving my own skills by conducting another course, doing another workshop. So it's all about me, me, me. But because the client has either a straightforward problem, which is like, okay, I want to learn how to write articles, or a problem that goes off at a tangent, which is how do I attract clients and therefore how do I write articles? So either way it works. But these are approximately the two ways that you can create content and you already knew that.
Interesting. Yes, yes. It was very surprising when you said, "I write for me." That's quite an insight there as well. Because I'd always assumed, you know, you pick an audience and you write for an audience, but actually, it seems you get more momentum when you're writing for yourself. I mean, I suppose it's. So I didn't want to spend, you know, to add another question, and you just made me think that obviously when you're writing for yourself, to almost skill, you know, you almost slightly educate yourself whilst you're doing it. Is it not easier to sort of default to something you know really well, and then just think, oh, I can get this out quickly, versus I've got to learn something, then I've got to write about it, then I've got to sell it. Does that make sense?
I don't write something I don't know. I'm writing about something I know, but I'm writing about it in a way that makes it different from what I know. I don't know if this makes sense, but as I'm writing, my whatever experience I've had and some new experiences based on what I've read or based on what I've heard, that kind of unfolds into the book. So when I started to write the book on testimonials, because that's the most bizarre book, no one needs 100+ pages on testimonials. But when I started writing it, it was a 27-page book. I had written a 27-page book, and then someone said, you know, I want to promote this book. And I think it was Brian Clark from Copyblogger. I don't know why. One day he just woke up and he wanted to promote the book, and he doesn't do anything like that. Anyway, I sat down and I started writing the book. It took me a week, and then it ballooned to over 100 and some pages. And I don't think there was much of a promotion. But the point is that somewhere along the way, something had gone from 27 pages to 100+ pages in my head. So it was that kind of unfolding that was happening. I'm not really looking to research something and figure out something. I write until I run out of stuff in my head, and then I stop.
Lovely. That seems a much more simple way of doing it. I just think the book I'm writing at the moment, I spent far too long researching, condensing, trying to understand, and then writing it. And it's also ballooned as well, from going from what I was hoping would be a 30-page book to something like 100. And it's suffering from bloat at the moment. So my wife is doing some quite brutal editing for me at the moment, which is quite nice. So yes, that's very good advice. Because actually, that probably leads to the second question, which I had was, you know, how long does it actually take when you're writing a book? I mean, I guess you've got your 16-page brain audit when you very first started out versus the, you know, you're ending up with 100+, you know, 200 pages, you know, brain audit that it is now. I mean, how long does it actually take you before you put pen to paper?
It could take several weeks. It could take several weeks just working out drafts. I work out draft after draft after draft, and then I have a deadline for drafts. And I mentioned this earlier today as well in another interview. But that's what I focus on. I focus on the drafts, not on the writing. And a lot of people focus on the writing, which is a complete waste of time, because you need to clarify what two or three things or four things, four main topics you're going to cover, and what are the subtopics under that. And if you don't clarify that, then you waste a lot of time writing stuff, which really goes nowhere. So a lot of my time goes in drafts, but the drafts have a deadline. And then I start writing. And then once I start writing, I will get two or three other people who bug me for the next installment. Because if I'm left to my own devices, I'll never do anything. Especially if I don't have a deadline, nothing will get done. So usually what I have is something happening where someone is going to bug me, or there is a course coming up or something. I have to finish something. Otherwise, I've been known to put off things for like 7 years.
Wow. Yeah. But clearly you keep yourself immensely busy in between those 7 years, you know. Yeah. That's that I understand that the importance of the deadline. I think I rely on my wife for that at the moment. So yeah. And so I mean the third question really was then, I suppose when you've done it and you've got the importance of drafts, I completely get that, and it's actually, you know, it's designed up and it's out in the market. I know this overlaps slightly with your, you know, dartboard pricing territory, but you know, what price do you set? I mean, I've set, say, in my head £25 whenever I publish mine which actually isn't in 3 months time now. But yeah, I've just set £25 and that's it. But do you do anything where you look at competitors, you know, when setting your price, or do you just think, yeah, that's the price and people will pay it?
I have no clue what competitors do. I seriously don't. I don't know what they write. I don't know what they price. I don't know what they do. I live on an island all by myself. And we literally have a conversation like, how much do you want to charge for this? $39, $49 It will start at some point and then go up from there. But the conversation is just as random as, should we take an umbrella or not?
Yeah. I find that wonderfully refreshing. It's great, yeah.
But then we will increase the prices, because what we have is a very systematic method, which is, okay, say we wanted $39 for the book. Well, that was the premium, and then we have the regular, which would be, say, $36. Now, if 100% or 99% buy at $39, then we know that that is a feasible figure. So we make that the regular, that is 39, and then we take the premium up to, say, 43 or something. And everybody buys at 43, then when 43 becomes a regular and 47 becomes the premium. So you're never, ever taking a risk. You're never saying, okay, this is going to be big trouble. No, you're always saying, well, 100% are buying at this price. Now I'll put $4 more and see if they buy at that price, or $6 more, or whatever. It never has to be a problem. But we've known to jump 20% over time, or 30%, just to push the boundaries. At other times, we've reduced prices. When we started out, our workshops were 1,500. Now they're around 800. The point is that it depends on your strategy as well. So maybe starting out at 25 is a good strategy, and then rolling out from there is a good idea. But it could be just as valuable to start out at $200 or £200. Just to have a benchmark that makes a 75-pound book more valuable. But then it depends on how much people know you and how much they're willing to trust you.
Yeah, actually, funny enough, that really sets up funny. That was part of my sub question, if you like, with this one. When nobody knows you, I was assuming that you should probably start a bit lower rather than come into the market at, say, £200, or sorry, dollars, I should almost say, but starting the market at, say, $200 versus, say, $25, it's probably best to stick with the $25 when you're starting out and work your way up. Almost like you've got to earn it.
It's not true. When we started out, we were selling at higher than the market rate. So you could go into a store and buy a hardbound book for $16. No one bought ebooks. So we were selling it at $29, then at $35, then $45, and it kept going up. And until 2009, you could only go from free to $119 or $139. So the Brain Audit itself was $119 or $139. I forget how much it was, just the Brain Audit book. This is up to 2009. So it's not true, because a lot of people come to the website have never seen us before. So it's not that we have a reputation with them. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. they will buy consistently, not from the website, but from the newsletter. That's a very important point to figure out. They will subscribe not from the website, but from the podcast to 5000 BC. So the launching point or the buying point is almost never the website. They get pushed through to the website through a newsletter. They get pushed from the podcast or from a video or something like that. But it's always something else. It's never the website itself.
I see. I'd never realized that before. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense actually when you say it, but I completely understand. Because funnily enough, when you say actually sort of arriving at the website, this the fourth question I had was about selling it somewhere like Amazon. So in the theory in my head, you know, not that it's reality, but in the theory in my head, I thought, well, let's publish something on Amazon. It seems fairly quickly nowadays with Amazon, you can put it up there. Obviously you need to pre-sell it as well, but the idea would be if you could get enough traffic coming from Amazon, that would be more traffic coming to your site. And so I suppose the question I then had was, you know, should every book be published in Amazon, or is it about creating a factor of scarcity that you should really only have it available on your site?
It really depends. I mean, frankly speaking, there is no reason why you can't have it on both at the same price. So, for instance, if you're selling a product at $39, you could have it at $39 on Amazon as well. There is no reason why you should not have it, and there is no reason why anybody would not buy it. Essentially, the reason why you buy anything is because you feel intense pressure for that knowledge, and a lot depends on the cover. A lot depends on what you write. A lot depends on the testimonials. People aren't buying necessarily because of the price. Now, if you're putting it on Amazon, then people are comparing it with other books which are $20 or whatever. So if your book is $39, it means that there is going to be that comparison factor. However, we sell The Brain Audit on Amazon at $39, a physical book. We sell it on our site at $39, and people go to both places and buy it. So the trick is that the Amazon ecosystem is completely different. And what they do is the best way to actually make any money off Amazon is to have several books, because the moment you have several books, then once Amazon realizes that, hey, you know, Simon just bought this book, he's going to like more of this book. So they start marketing for you instead of you marketing all by yourself. So they keep sending you books saying, hey, you know, you liked The Brain Audit? Well, Sean's written this book. And then they'll send you a third book, and then they'll send you a fourth book. And that's how you sell books on Amazon, if you want to make money on Amazon, that is. But it's still a very crowded place.
Yeah. Understood. It's one thing in my head. I struggle to see how to stand out there. And I mean, that's one reason I, you know, buy via your site. I just think, well, it's only available here. And if it's only available here, well, minus The Brain Audit, then I'm going to buy it here. And if that's the price, then that's the price. And I don't really think much else. I think, well, that's it. Let's go for it. Well, then, I mean, just also clearly, you know, the testimonials when buying from it, that was one big question I had, because you know, actually picking up testimonials before you actually launch a book, clearly, you know, when you're writing something from scratch, there aren't any testimonials clearly, because it's just yourself having written it and seen it. But once you send it out to a few people, I mean, I'm thinking, how many testimonials should you get, if you can ever quantify it? Is it about getting 5 great ones or 15 great ones? What's that thing you need?
The testimonials need to be specific. So, for instance, and I'll go out on a limb for this, it doesn't have to be a Seth Godin testimonial. Because a Seth Godin testimonial would say, that was a wonderful book, I had a great time reading it, which says absolutely nothing. So your testimonial has to be the opposite of that. It has to be a testimonial that says something specific. I was struggling with writing the opening of my newsletter, but after reading this book, I was able to do it in 30 minutes. To me, that's like saving half the day. To me, that is like a story in itself. So if the testimonial is a mini story and experience, then it's very hard for the customer to go, well, let me just ignore this. They'll say, well, let me just take a chance on it. It's got a money-back guarantee or whatever, so I'll take a chance on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Got you. That makes a lot of sense.
And when you're getting the testimonials, get the person not to talk about the book, but to talk about a chapter, to talk about three paragraphs, to talk about stuff. So, for instance, in The Brain Audit, I can tell you, go to page 89 and talk about the 6 questions that you have to ask and how that changed your life. That's how you do it.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah. That makes, so that's how you get something quite specific that would really help you. Yeah, or help you sell it rather than testimonials.
And
your
it's
site.
Quick.
Yeah.
They don't have to read a book. I just have to read a chapter. I just have to read a page. I just have to read 3 pages. I can do that.
I see. Because I was thinking, gosh, do I ask? If I send this book out to, say, 15 people or something like that, they're going to have to read, 90, 100 pages. And I think that's quite a lot to ask for somebody, you know, when people are busy. So, getting them to focus on a few pages sounds good. Well, actually, in which I was going to ask then, before you sort of send it out for testimonials, just getting somebody to, this is almost like the final question, and I see I've got 21 minutes ticking for a 22-minute call as well. But how many people should critique your book and maybe just sort of go into a bit more depth, not having just to read, say, one or two pages, but say, actually, I've read your whole book, you probably should shift chapter 2 to chapter 3 and get rid of chapter 4 or whatever it is. How many people should do that depth of critique?
I usually get 2 or 3 people to do that because they come back with totally different experiences. I usually get clients to do that, someone maybe who signed up for a course, I'm writing for that course. They're more involved. But if you can't do that, then yeah, you're going to get 2 or 3 people because they're going to have completely different angles to what to the way you're going to approach your book. And yeah, 2 or 3 is my end. That's what I do.
Fantastic. That seems quite manageable as well. I mean, I did have a seventh question, but actually looking at it, it's going to be more broad, which is about how to design your book when you have no design skills. And I think that's all, feels almost like a topic in itself.
So it's called Canva.com, Canva. They have a whole bunch of books that, so that's the cover. You're talking about the cover of the book. They have a whole bunch of covers. Go out there, I think. Technically, it's free. There might be some loophole somewhere, but figure your way through the loophole and you'll get your cover.
I see. I thought it was going to be more complex than that. Excellent. Amazing. Isn't technology wonderful? Thank you. And, as a side note as well, Sean, thanks for sending over those InDesign videos as well. So I've been having a good play around with those. I appreciate it. So I'm happily do those vanishing reports for you as well whenever it's good. So it's really exciting. Really enjoy it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Lovely. Well, I mean, thank you. It really is an absolute pleasure and honor to speak to you. It's funny typing away all day, sending emails via or messages via 5000 BC or email, but it's lovely to, it's lovely to speak over the delights of Skype as well. So yeah, from one side of the world to the other.
You're welcome. Enjoy your morning in lovely Blackpool.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, I will. I'll go and get a nice cup of tea at the moment. So yes, I'm trying.
Very,
excellent.
Very English. Yeah.
Yes, but I'm not having any milk at the moment. I'm trying to move away from milk, so I'm having a nice black tea, which I'm much preferring nowadays. So yeah, that's it.
That's good. Thanks, Simon.
Okay. Thanks so much, Sean. All the best. Yeah, cheers.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.